This is Heart of Iowa, a patchwork of artists, public speakers, individuals of note, and alternative viewpoints in central Iowa. Welcome. Oasis is a group of Christians, Muslims, and Jews who live in our area and who gather together two or three times a year as neighbors. As people of faith, they discuss the world, problems, and their beliefs. Those of no religious affiliation are also invited to join the conversation. The group is led by Susan Stanton, who is of the Catholic faith. Oasis met last June at the Ames Jewish Congregation Building, and KHOI was there to record their conversation. Let's listen in.
My name is Sue Stanton, and this is KHOI. Today on the Heart of Iowa show, I am pleased to have with me a group of Central Iowa folks who I have known for the last 6 years. Each of us belong to Oasis, a group of Catholic Christians, Muslims, and Jews who have been gathering together in conversation as people of faith, eager to discuss the world's events and problems that go hand in hand with our turbulent times. As members of the three Abrahamic traditions, we have come together because we believe it is important to sit down with one another and discuss these kinds of topics as neighbors. We also invite people of no religious affiliation to join us as well. I want to emphasize to our listening audience that no one here speaks authoritatively for their religious community. There are no priests, imams, or rabbis seated among us. We usually meet three or four times a year. And if you would like more information about Oasis, you can contact the station, KHOI. Before we begin, I'd like to thank the Jewish community for hosting this event today and allowing KHOI to record our discussion. Thank you very much. When we first began doing this so many years ago, we started out with a set of rules for discussion. I'd like to read them for our listeners to just give you an idea of where we are coming from in our discussion. As Oasis members, we wish to understand one another through the basis of our words and what they mean to each of us as people who come from a wide, rich, and diverse array of cultural backgrounds. We understand that speech and speaking with one another can accomplish social change, and that face-to-face contact can never be replaced. We understand that religion or no religious beliefs is a part of our social interaction and cultural exchange. We understand that at times religion is being used as a weapon to inflict harm on one another. We understand that all humans embrace a sense of identity through a belief or non-belief system. We understand that the ability to listen and the discipline that an open mind demands, especially in situations where views may be contradictory to our own, does not diminish, dilute, impact, or reflect on our own religion's beliefs. We understand that we are the only ones in charge of our own beliefs, and we understand that we each are people of inherent dignity. This is not bestowed. It is already in place. And finally, we understand that each person comes to the setting with their own experiences of anger and pain. And so right now, I would like to go around the table and have everyone introduce themselves and the religious affiliation they represent. As I said in the beginning, my name is Sue Stanton, and I'm an over 30-year member of St. Cecilia Catholic Community here in Ames.
I am Salahuddin Syed. I am representing the Islamic Center and Islamic Faith. I have been living in Ames for the last 6 years.
My name is Martin Edelson. I'm representing the Ames Jewish Congregation. I've lived in Ames for about 35 years.
I'm John Pleasance. I'm a member of the Ames Jewish Congregation. We've lived in Ames for 34 years.
I'm Barbara Pleasance, also from the Ames Jewish Congregation, and of course also 34 years in Ames.
Amazing. Do I know you?
I'm Doris Santiago. I'm a Catholic, and I have been living in Ames for 4 years now.
I'm Elizabeth Bomer. I'm also Catholic, and I've been here for about 16 years.
My name is Sayed Adam. I'm a Muslim by religion in Ames with my family since 1994.
I'm Rose Tandra. I go to St. Cecilia Church, and we've lived here since 1968.
Thank you. Tonight, I think what we would like to do is start out with a topic on women's issues in the world. Just this evening, coming in the door, people were talking about the Book of Job and women's wisdom. It might be interesting to hear what the discussion had initially revolved around between one of our Catholic participants and one of our Jewish participants. Doris, would you like to reconstruct for us what your initial Bible study was talking about the Book of Job?
Yeah, one of the questions we were trying to answer, it was, how do we understand God's will in our life?
Do you think that women asking that question of God is different from when men ask it? In the Catholic tradition, we have Mary at the moment when God asks her to carry Jesus in her womb and give birth to Jesus and raise Jesus. And Mary's instant yes is, for many women, that major connection to the Catholic tradition. So in Job, was there a reflection of that? Or how did women look at Job's suffering? You know, a man suffering, for one thing, is different from a man, from a woman suffering. And how did the women in that group address that?
We, as women, understand better his suffering than our male companion. I think as women, we are more open to understand suffering. And I think because men have always had the authority, it's hard to let God be the authority instead of them.
Martin, you were in a group of women, and how many women?
Three women and one man. We're at a point in the Book of Job where Job has completed his defense, I would say, against the accusations of his friends. His friends come to him after all of these terrible tragedies have befallen him. His children have been killed. All of his property has been taken away, and he's been visited with terrible bodily afflictions, just short of death. And they try to get from him the reason why these tragedies have befallen him, because certainly he must have in some way sinned in order to justify the treatment that he's received. And Job steadfastly defends himself and asserts that he's always been faithful. He remains faithful, and he doesn't understand the reason why this punishment has been visited upon him, but he recognizes that it is something from God. And by virtue of that, he has to accept it. He has to bear up and maintain his faith. One of the women in our group asked where the women were in the story. There are three male friends of Job, and a fourth comes along as well. And you hear conversations between them. And Job's wife makes a very, very brief appearance early in the story when she counsels him to essentially lose his faith. How can you believe in a God that would do this to you? And he doesn't accept her counsel. He retains his faith. I don't know whether she returns the story or not, but she hasn't so far.
We haven't gone that far, but we haven't encountered any other women. We are still going through his friends. So.
I doubt that we'll find any other women, which might be a measure of the patriarchal society of that day.
Well, but that also is the most pivotal question in the story. I mean, she's throwing down the gauntlet. How can you believe in this kind of God? Which means that she may believe in another kind of God. What Doris said earlier about women, they're more accepting of suffering. Maybe that's because women are childbearers.
No, they live with men.
Or they live with men. Men become childbearers.
Suffering.
And then they have child men. And then they suffer. But yeah, women have this built-in suffering every month, this ordeal of womanhood. And so, yes, it's not that you consciously struggle with how can a God do this to me, but
what you do struggle with is acceptance and loss, and acceptance and birth and loss, and birth and loss, and maybe that acceptance of the whole completion of the cycle is what women have a little bit of advantage. And so Job's wife's question would be exactly the transformative moment. How can you believe in this God who takes things away? It's about a God who gives. God kind of treats Job like, well, you gotta suck it up and take it or something.
Well, you know, Job seems quite sophisticated in his understanding of man versus God. And he's quite willing to accept that both good and bad things emanate from God. His friends don't understand how the bad things cannot be the result of some violation of God's law, but he steadfastly denies it.
I would like to say that as a woman, I would not be comforted to know that my entire family was wiped out, even if it was replaced by another family. But Job is, apparently. So he may have a sense of order that he needed to have reestablished. That's only a guess. I don't know.
One thing that always strikes me when we see tornadoes and the disaster from tornadoes is people who don't perish in the tornado often will thank God for saving them. But it seems kind of odd. So who is responsible for the tornado? Did God send the tornado but then save them from the tornado simultaneously? Or did the tornado come from something else? I mean, couldn't you blame God for the tornado? It's always very odd to me that they're looking for the silver lining in this, despite the fact that all sorts of devastation has been wreaked upon them and their friends and family. Very much like Job, but in this case, people aren't accepting that the tornado came from God.
I suspect that when Job was written, it was a more common attitude.
Oh, absolutely.
That everything that happened in the world to you and to everyone else was through the act of God.
Like John was saying, who sent the tornado? If you suspend that for a minute, it allows the human side to pronounce judgment. Okay, it doesn't matter who sent the tornado. We're here to judge you, and we're going to judge you in this manner or this manner. You deserve this, or I deserve this. And because then God saved me, I deserved it, but I was saved, and so therefore the cycle is complete in someone's mind.
Well, the cruel thing is, what about the people who were killed by the tornado? Is one to infer that these were sinful people, that somehow God's judgment was visited upon them because of some acts that they had done or not done? It's terrible to have this feeling. And when a great earthquake comes and thousands of people are killed, and including young children and newborn children and the very elderly, how do you rationalize that with some act of God? We read a little bit ahead, and coming up is God's answer and his friends, and basically God is telling Job to suck it up. You don't understand. You can't understand the things I do. I who have created the universe, I who have done all these absolutely unfathomable things. So just take it. You can't understand it.
You know, from an Islamic perspective, there are two things that the Quran describes. It says every good and bad thing that happens to humanity is either a test or a punishment or a reward for your actions. So if something good happens to me, it is a reward from me, or it is a test for me. For example, if I gain wealth, how do I respond and use that wealth? Do I use it to create more wealth and abuse people, or is it to be more charitable and spread the wealth around? Or either other way is, if I get too poor, too desperate, do I start doing uncivilized things? Do I sell my children, or do I go and do prostitution or become a pimp? So you can suffer in a better way, or you can go bad in a worse way by being poor. Same thing with rich people. They can destroy themselves by taking drugs or shooting themselves off. If you pass that test, God is going to reward you multiple times in the hereafter. That's why the belief in the hereafter is the foundation of one of the Islamic faiths. Because this world cannot be just for us, because this world is finite. If all the people in this room beat me up, yeah, that's the end of this room story. But the hereafter is longer than that.
So if something bad happens to you or you're poor, whatever situation you're in is not a good situation, and you view that as a test, the question is whether God is testing you. Did God put you in that situation in order to test you? So ultimately the question is whether things that happen in the world are all by the hand of God, or whether there are, quote, natural events that happen, which could test us, but it's not God giving us exam after exam after exam on something. It's just how we respond to the natural things that happen in the world.
Well, it's also bad things that happen because of the behavior of people. Since I teach the Holocaust, I'll bring that up as an example. Some people, in looking for an explanation to something like that, might say it's something we did and we're being punished for. But the alternative is this was an act of humans. I mean, to say that God would send such an event to test people, what kind of God would that be that would do such a thing? These kinds of major horrid events, especially perpetrated by humans as opposed to natural events, I think that really raises these kinds of issues of the nature of God. And would you say that God did that as a test?
It is a horrible event happening to anybody in the world. That's an innocent person being killed. But at the same time, remember I told you that the power was given to somebody then to kill Jews at that time. The power that was given was a test to those people. And it was a test for two people at the same time. The victims and the perpetrators who did there's a test on both. How did the powerful react at that time? They are people who abused their power and killed innocents. And they are responsible for their actions in the hereafter, because this world cannot punish them so many times. So God is just. He will be just to the people, innocent people who are killed, regardless of their beliefs. So people who suffer without them doing anything, God has to be just to them. So he will be just to them. Not in this world, because this world is not meant for justice.
I think the Jewish point of view is that it's up to us to have justice in this world. Justice is an extremely important concept, and the hereafter is not as important, which makes it much harder to deal with horrid events, because you can't say it's going to be fixed later. The rights will be wronged later. So it makes it much more difficult, I think, to have a discussion of Job or to have a discussion of anything of this nature if you expect the world to be a just place, and it's up to us to make it a just place.
I believe that attitude has led to social action on the part of Jews throughout history, because they see an important role making the world a better place and a fairer place. They can't rely on the notion that, okay, things are terrible now, but after I die, things will be better for me.
That's not what I am trying to say. What I'm trying to say is this world's justice is finite. You cannot punish those people who committed those crimes 6 million times, for example. Even though we may be able to punish some of them, but we human beings don't have the wisdom of knowing the whole story. So our justice is limited, but God's justice is, you know, it's unlimited. God is the one who is ultimate judge, and he is going to judge everybody accordingly.
Muhammed'e, Muhammed'e, Mevlam layık eylemizi Muhammed'e, Muhammed'e.
You are listening to Part of Iowa, a patchwork of artists, public speakers, individuals of note, and alternative viewpoints in central Iowa. Today we are listening to a conversation of Oasis, an interfaith group of local residents who meet two or three times a year to converse as neighbors and share their worldviews. All are welcome, including people of no faith. For more information or to join their conversation, contact KHOI at khoiradio@gmail.com, khoiradio@gmail.com, or at 515-292-2878. And of course, we always welcome your visiting us at 410 Douglas in the old Ames Pantorium building.
It's a consoling thought to think that everybody will get their comeuppance at some point in time, whether in this life or the afterlife, and that everything's a zero-sum game if we think of it as the big picture. But for Jews, the concept of the afterlife is not all that important and really is very poorly defined. We don't talk about it very much. There is some notion that there is some afterlife, but it's not the place where things are evened out. The concept of hell, for example, is a very larval concept that's not really very well defined, place where you would go to be punished, or conversely, a heaven, a place where you'd go to be rewarded, is not really spelled out either. It's kind of a nebulous notion. So for Jews, good works are what is very important. To accomplish something, this is your lifetime. This is the world in which you're dealing with. So again, this world in which we live, no question about it, is finite, and certainly full justice cannot be achieved oftentimes in this world. But that's the world that we have. That's the world that we live in, and we have to do the best that we can. It means you have to do things. You know, what's important for you to be a good whatever it is you are? For example, the concept of being a monk doesn't make a lot of sense. Somebody who just goes someplace and prays all day and doesn't do anything in particular.
Withdraws from the world.
Don't
they make wonderful wines?
Sometimes they make good bread too, I've heard. But though, you know, individuals who withdraw themselves from the world, now again, we can get into the power of prayer and whether that exists or not. But the idea is that you're given this life, you have to do something to make the world a better place. Go out and do it.
I think there is no two opinions on that, even among the Muslims, that you have to spend this life to make this world a better place. That is a given, that is a requirement per se. I mean, there is a verse in Quran which says, if innocent person is killed, it is as if the whole humanity has been killed. And if an innocent person is saved, it's like you have saved the entire humanity. So by no means the suffering of any group or any individuals can be said, okay, this is God-given, so just ignore it and move on. That's definitely not the case.
I did read a little ahead, and I know it has what is described as a happy ending, although the children that were killed are still slain, and all the livestock are still gone, and you know all the terrible things haven't mysteriously disappeared. Nobody has awakened him and said this all was a dream. He does get new children. I don't know whether he gets a new wife or not. I think it's a very sophisticated attitude. It's certainly not one that I share, but he has a very complete understanding of man and God and the universe.
I think we are talking about two kinds of people here. Hmm? Job is called as Ayyub in the Quran. That's why I was trying to look at what it's called
Ayyub.
As. Ayyub. Hmm? So the story of Ayyub was he had suffered a lot of diseases, sickness. Hmm? And if you look at all the prophets of God in the scriptures, all of them went through a lot of tests. Abraham, we talked about this in one of these sessions we had, was told by God to sacrifice his own son. Just imagine God telling me to go and sacrifice my $1,000. I will have trouble, right? So here we have a prophet of God. He didn't choose a Job to go and become a prophet. He chose a very righteous person. the belief in God was like super. And they were not like shaky people like us. When things fall apart, we kind of run away from the faith. That's why they are prophets. They are not human beings like us.
But Job's not a prophet, is he?
He is.
He is in the Quran.
In the Quran, he is one of the prophets of God. And he says that he suffered so much in his life, he lost everything. His kids went away, his wife left him, but still he held on to his belief. God gave you everything. And you are born with perfect health. So when he has given everything without even us even asking a millisecond, he can take away certain things. That's what God is saying. Well, I gave you everything. I'm giving you one skin disease. Can you take it? If he gives me cancer, can I take it? It's a test. He gave me this beautiful body. Just one lung cancer, I'll be like coughing and I'll be like cursing everybody and they're like, why did God give me this thing? But those prophets had the level of their faith was so high. They said, well, everything comes from God. Everything is given by God. Say, Alhamdulillah, means praise be to God.
The story sort of fudges the notion that God is handing out the punishment by introducing Satan. It turns into somewhat of a game, a contest between Satan and God. That is a bit of a misdirection play, I think.
So when things happen, is everything that happens reflect the hand of God? If you get cancer, did God give you cancer? If a tornado comes and destroys your house, did God do that? If you believe that the hand of God is in everything, then, boy, you're put in a tough spot because, again, if a lot of bad things happen to you, you have to think about, well, what does that mean? And the book of Job, I don't think it gives us a really good answer to that. And looking around, we don't see good answers to that necessarily. Now, on the other hand, if you think that there is a God that is active in the world, but not everything that happens in the world can be attributed to God. I mean, I remember when I was in college, I had friends who were very devout Catholics. If they looked at the gas gauge and it was empty, and they managed to make it to a gas station, thanks God for that. Now, maybe he did that. Maybe not. Maybe she did that. Right? But it seems to me it makes life very difficult to interpret when you think that God is responsible for everything.
It's simple, isn't it?
It is simple in one sense. I mean, there's this phrase, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away, and what comes next? Blessed be God. So you can take that interpretation of it and retain your faith, and maybe that is simple. There are a lot of things that happen that are just the result of natural phenomena. And we may be tested by that. I mean, it's going to be difficult to deal with cancer. But it wasn't that God gave me the cancer. At the same time, a belief in God may help me get through this. But, if I think that God gave me the cancer as a test, well, that's... I mean, why is God going around doing these things? And why are some people just have the crap tested out of them and other people are relatively untested? These are difficult things to wrestle with. There's a famous book written by a Jew, Kushner, on why bad things happen to good people. I don't know what he actually comes up with as a conclusion to that, but certainly bad things happen to good people. We know that.
One of the things we have in Islam is called as Qadr. That means everything happens by the will of God, good and bad. That's one of the beliefs, basic beliefs in Islamic creed. And every suffering that we have, if you are not responsible for that, God is going to repay you. So you take whatever you get in this world. For example, I don't have any way of controlling my lung cancer because I don't smoke, I don't drink. So there is no other thing I can do. So if I get lung cancer, it's because God's will.
Radon.
I mean, the word radon did not exist 100 years back.
Oh, yes, it did.
What I'm trying to say is, when people did not know the reasons for certain things,
well, sure,
they just say, okay, that's the will of God. Who else can you blame? Can I blame you for that? No. That's kind of silly to blame you for.
You could.
But the point is, God is very active in our life, according to Islamic belief. And we say everything happens is because God wanted it to happen. The more you suffer, the higher your level of place in heaven is.
There was an interesting survey done. It was an article in Time magazine. I think it was the Pew Trust or something. But they looked at different attitudes towards God among Americans of different religions. And I was mostly at different types of Christians, and Jews were included. I don't think Muslims were included. But most Jews came out on the end of the spectrum of, if there's a God, God is distant and not really involved in the day-to-day. I mean, that's really much more the majority view.
Like a hands-off approach?
Yeah. We're not sure. God may have had some role, but not concerned with the day-to-day goings-on, which perhaps makes these kinds of questions easier to deal with because God didn't do that to me. Like John said, if you think God has a hand in everything, then you're going to be faced with very difficult questions. You either accept it or you're going to blame God. And it seems to me the Job story makes God somewhat capricious. Let's just have this bet and see what happens. And how do you deal with that if you think God's active in the world and God would do that to you just because someone challenged God?
That is not part of the Quranic story, actually. It's totally different.
Yeah.
Notion of a capricious God is more like the stories of the Roman gods or the Greek gods, who were basically just narcissistic people who did silly things and bet with each other and did bad things to people just for the fun of it. And in a sense, although that seems, who would want such a god, or gods in this case, because there are a number of, the capriciousness aspect does capture what really happens in this world. Things that happen are very capricious. Again, good things happening to bad people. It doesn't make any sense. The logic isn't there. As Barbara says, it's easier to deal with the capriciousness, which is a natural events are capricious. You know, whether a tornado comes or not is capricious. Although if you live near the Oklahoma City area, capricious seems to happen over and over again, and maybe it's not so capricious after all.
I'd like to ask if anybody knows what covenant was in effect at that time, or the writing of Job.
What do you mean by covenant?
There were many different covenants, some with God and creation, then God and the family of Abraham. So my question is, was Job under the covenant with creation?
Israelites at that time, or Jews, would be part of that covenant. The covenant is with the Jewish people.
Okay.
So if Job is a member of that people, then presumably that covenant applies. I mean, so historically, I don't know historically when the book was written.
Well, the background of the question is that a campus psychiatrist named Miriam Grossman did studies in psychology and psychiatry concerning people who regularly worshipped across all religions. The most hardy people were those who regularly worship. Every place on the planet, she found that to be true. And at the end of Job, he is finding again the context of his life, possibly in the context of covenant.
I just want to make a comment here on the checking my dictionary for the word capricious. For those of us who had to check the dictionary meaning of that word,
it could mean this, or it could mean that, or something else too.
It
right?
means impulsive or unpredictable.
Yeah.
So that sounds like a Job type God.
There are 99 attributes described in the Islamic literature, and that's not one of the
attributes of God.
That's not the nature of God.
Impulsive and unpredictable?
No, that's not.
But nature is. Nature is capricious and unpredictable, and so when we see unpredictable or capricious things happening, my inclination would be that this is a natural phenomenon. How I deal with it, my religion and notion of God may help me deal with that. But the fact that it happened, I'm not going to attribute that to God.
Yet insurance companies call those acts of God,
right,
don't they?
Right, right.
And thus don't insure them.
That's very interesting.
Because they know God is capricious.
But where is the hope? Is there no hope in Job? If God is just like this guy who's rolling the dice, where is hope?
Well, of course, Job doesn't know about any wager that is at the beginning of the story. Job sees the acts that have been perpetrated upon him and his family as being the work of God. And he accepts that. He maintains his faith. And I guess at the end he's rewarded for maintaining his faith when much of his wealth and new family is visited upon him. And maybe God thinks that evens the books. But it's a parable that says, as terrible as things look, don't give up faith. If you keep faith, you'll be rewarded in the end.
But is that hope? And Sal, I wanted to ask you. Job looks at it, this is God's will. You're walking along, and you're always, anything bad that smacks you in the face, you just say, well, this is God's will. But sooner or later, every human projects outward. They project a timeline that says, sooner or later, something better has to happen. Did that occur in Job? Did you get a sense of that occurring?
All I can say is that Job has so far maintained his faith, despite all the criticism leveled against him by his friends and his wife. And I'm sure, you know, God is very pleased. that this man is behaving the way he hopes all of his creation will behave towards him, and keep the faith regardless of the terrible tragedies that are visited upon them.
I will think that Job does project that, because he comes to the point of saying how he has behaved really well. Why is this happening to him? I mean, that's...
He doesn't understand it, certainly.
He's trying to understand why is God punishing him, and he's also trying to tell his friends, no, I didn't sin. So I think in a way, he responds to God, like, why are you doing this to me? Answer me.
Now, Job is rewarded in the end. I mean, he gets his things back, although he doesn't get people. His livestock are still dead, his original sons are still dead. But there's this notion of reward. Now, in this case, we note that that reward comes in this life. And again, because Jews tend to downplay the afterlife, this notion of balancing the scorecards is difficult. There's certainly a very appealing notion to the people who lived 1,000 years ago or so, whose lives were miserable, and there was no hope of getting out of those lives. If you were a peasant slaving in the fields, that was your lot in life, and things were not going to get better. Now, people do have the opportunity to raise themselves up from certain conditions, and we were watching something on TV just the other night on Sonia Sotomayor, the U.S. Supreme Court, who grew up in the Bronx, knew nothing about the Supreme Court or anything, but was able to achieve this high place. But for many points in history, that wasn't the case. Your life was miserable. It was always going to be miserable. The only hope you had was that the afterlife was going to be good. And so that could keep you going. On the other hand, if you were a Jew and you didn't believe that there was an afterlife, well, that particular type of hope was gone. So how you dealt with that, I'm not sure.
I don't think it's mutually exclusive.
The notion of the afterlife as a place where the scores are even is a very appealing notion. If you are a powerless person and have no hope of power, your only hope will be that somehow in the afterlife you'll be rewarded for sticking with it your entire life. And on the other hand, the person who was abusing you is going to get their comeuppance at some point in the future.
That is true, yes. That gives a lot of hope and the energy to keep going.
Right.
Like you were talking about the African-American struggle. Yes, there was a point where there looks like there was no hope for them. In this country, they will be slaves forever. But with constant struggle, today we have an African-American president.
You are listening to Heart of Iowa, a patchwork of artists, public speakers, individuals of note, and alternative viewpoints in central Iowa. Today we are listening to a conversation of OASIS, an interfaith group of local residents who meet two or three times a year to converse as neighbors and share their worldviews. All are welcome, including people of no faith. For more information or to join their conversation, contact KHOI at khoiradio@gmail.com, khoiradio@gmail.com, or at 515-292-2878.
My name is Sue Stanton, and we are having an interfaith dialogue from the group OASIS. We had been talking previously about Job and this projection of heaven. I think it would really be interesting for listeners to hear, maybe from the three different Abrahamic traditions, their idea of what heaven is. When I was a kid in K-12, Catholic school. Once a week, Father would come to religion class, and he would go around the room, and he would say, okay, what is your idea of heaven? First, he told us when we got to heaven, we could have anything we wanted. If we wanted ice cream all day, we could have that. If we wanted a horse, finally, we could have that. That was, you know, for third graders, that was wonderful. Of course, there were many preconditions. I read a book by the famous Egyptian Muslim author Naguib Mahfouz called The Seventh Heaven. It was a story about a man who was killed by his best friend, and the guy who was killed went to heaven, and when he reached the first level of heaven, well, he had a choice. He could stay and work on going up to the second level, or he could go back to earth and walk the path with that friend to see if he couldn't make him be a better person. And that would allow him to achieve the second level of heaven. If I ruled heaven, that would be what I would make everyone do. No ice cream until you reach the second level.
There's some phrases that you never hear Jews utter. For example, when somebody dies and their spouse has preceded them, they're going to heaven to be with Uncle Joe or whatever it is like that. We don't say that.
We were just at a funeral last week. You don't hear the kinds of things I've heard at Catholic funerals of allusions to heaven in the funeral service. You really don't. And I think the reason for all of this is, even if you have some concept that there might be a heaven, as some Jews do, I think, it's not for us to speculate because we have no idea. We really have no idea what's going to happen. That's it. You don't dwell on it. You don't hear sermons about heaven and hell. But we're not really to speculate because we don't know.
There are many prayers and statements in our prayer book that refer to God having faith with those who sleep in the dust,
which seems to be something to do with the dead.
I've always personally interpreted that to mean the poor.
And I don't know if that's true, and I've wondered the same thing.
I doubt that is the accepted interpretation.
In the Hebrew Bible, I think the notion of heaven is really very, very little reference to a heaven or hell, or certainly not defining it in any way.
No reference to hell.
Or what happens there. Or the notion of something in the afterlife and heaven and hell did sort of creep into Judaism during the Babylonian captivity. So at the point where the Jews forcibly left the land of Israel and went to Babylon, at that point they encountered the Zoroastrians, and the Zoroastrians were into a lot of duality, and so they did have this concept of a heaven and a hell, and that notion, something along those lines, crept into Judaism at that point. That would be post the Hebrew Bible itself.
So while you guys were talking, I was looking at the reference in the Quran in the index. There are at least 75 references to heaven and hell each. So the concept of heaven and hell is very deep. It even describes the rivers that flow under your feet, flowing underneath, and there were rivers of honey and milk. No hunger, no pain, no suffering. So, and also defines who are eligible to go into heaven. And heaven, once you enter, it's forever. But hell can be for a temporary period of time for believers and non-believers both. Concept of Islam is to have to believe in heaven and hell both.
About hell in Islam, what is the notion of Satan or the devil? And how is that individual paired with hell in some way?
Satan is just a person like us. And he does not own or control the hell. Angels will control the heaven and hell both under the orders of God. God has ultimate control because he created heaven and hell both.
How do you get out of hell?
Of course, people who worship God and do other things, criminal things, can go into hell for a particular period of time. The basic concept is you have to worship God and God only to be into heaven. And still, if he or she does a sin, then he may have to punish. You know, if he did not repent for his sins from God and from the person who he sinned against, doesn't matter male or female, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, because if I sinned against a creation of God, which you are, say, if I sinned against you, God is not going to let me go off the hook just because I am a believer. I had to pay my sin.
The Pope made some general statement about non-believers, non-Catholics. There were some interesting notions in there, one of which was that Christ died for all of us, for everybody at this table, whether we believe in Christ or not, which seemed kind of a generous thing, but it sort of reminded me of the Mormons who posthumously bring people into the Mormon faith.
I cannot say particularly this group will enter, because I don't even know about me I'm going to enter or not.
But if you make it, yeah, either to heaven or hell, mm-hmm, would you be surprised to find Christians, yeah, and Jews there with you?
No, why should I?
So you would not be surprised.
Why should I?
Well, because God is the ultimate judge.
Exactly.
God has all the control.
God is the one who created all of us. God is the one who created heaven and hell. So if he decides to put somebody into heaven or hell, who am I to question that?
Did you ever read Penguin Island? When a priest who is losing his sight, mm-hmm, finds himself on an island with penguins and mistakes them for humans, mm-hmm, and converts them.
As Catholics, we believe that no human being has a right to go to heaven, because in the scriptures it says God is thrice holy. What we've been told that the Jewish meaning of that is that it's the superlative level of holiness, and we cannot deserve as human beings to share in that holiness, but that God has made it possible through the merits of Jesus, who died to redeem all human beings if they want to be redeemed.
Would Catholics accept that non-Catholics could be in their whatever their concept of heaven is,
yes,
if they have not accepted Jesus?
Yes, they would be in heaven if they have tried to live a good life as best they know how. But if they on purpose turn away from that, then they would not.
And I think that was part of what the Pope was talking about. Those who don't reject would be encompassed in all of this, but those who knowingly reject.
I think he was mostly talking about people's inherent goodness. Creation is originally blessed and inherently good, and that the concept of God and love and inclusion is broad. And the one thing that Catholics do have is three kinds of baptism. We have baptism by blood, by water, and by desire. And so who is to know what person's desire is? That's where you can get that broad inclusion. Only God knows the inner desire. To go to heaven as a Catholic, you have to be baptized Catholic and more or less raised Catholic. And what he was pulling back a little bit from that, and he just said, you know, there are other good people in the world, and they're not Catholic, you know, but they're still good, and they're still worthy of God. And then he went even so far as to say, and they could even be atheists. Atheists could be good people. Yes, so I mean, he just threw it all open, and it was very inclusive.
I'd like to comment on the quotation. Vatican II documents made a great emphasis on how Christians are related to other people. And I'm wondering if we can understand the Holy Father's comment in that context. We're related to Jews, and the documents say precisely how. We're related to all people of goodwill, and also all people who seek the truth. And so in those degrees, they are also related to Jesus, who won the redemption.
Because then if we have to be either Muslims or Jews or Catholic to go to heaven, where is that free will of not choosing any religion and just being...
I don't think Jews, from my understanding of what I've read, have any concept of exclusivity. Mm-hmm. So you're not excluded because you didn't believe something. Your actions are much more important than your beliefs. Mm-hmm. You could have no belief, but you were a good person, and that's what counts. It's what you do in this world that kind of takes the measure of you.
Goodness prevails in everyone. Yes, these are the rules, these are the deep thoughts, but this is the reality. So.
But we would distinguish a person who is created to be good, and then what they do.
Going back to this notion of original sin, I don't know if there's, in Islam, there's any concept of original sin.
Not.
It doesn't sound like...
Not the same kind of...
It's a troubling concept to think that child enters the world with some blemish, and that some other entity has to erase that.
Sin, we really call it sin? In Islam, actually, the word that is used is an error of forgetfulness. So how can an error of forgetfulness carry over to the next generation when God is so merciful and loving?
He's an infinite being. How can you limit
exactly
his
the tradition in ancient societies, memorization of books was very common.
But the Quran is the only scripture that has been preserved in its original tongue.
I could show you the Torah scrolls that are in Hebrew to this day, because the Torah is the first five books of the Bible, and it ends basically as they're about to go back to the land of Canaan, right? Moses dies and all. The whole thing is written in Hebrew.
The Hebrew Bible, the five books of Moses, or the Torah, and then additional writings like Job and so on, that is obviously a very important part of the religion, but that's not the only part.
Sure.
So they're writings that have come since then. And in Islam, there are writings that have come since the... And those have served to fashion the religion in some way, and Judaism has had to sort of reinvent itself at various points. It started out as a temple-based religion.
A single
temple in Jerusalem where you went and sacrificed animals and things like that, and that temple was destroyed. Then the next temple was destroyed. There is no temple there now, so the whole temple-based aspects of the religion disappeared. We're not capable of being done, and so what you had to do is come up with some way to keep the religion going, keep practices going, new rituals and so on to replace those.
Two questions for my own understanding. What is the Aramaic same as Hebrew, or is it a different language?
It's a related language, and it was the spoken language of Jesus' time. Actually, there are few Aramaic speakers, very few left, and I think the last ones were in Iraq. So there are very small populations that continue to speak it, but it's also, you know, basically an ancient language that is about died out. And that's what the Talmud is written in, because the Talmud is around the year 200-ish. Talmud is a compilation of writings and legends and rabbinic discussion, and it's a very complex document. So if you wanted to know what Judaism is about, you can't just go read the Hebrew Bible. It's a living religion that has evolved.
And you were mentioning the temple in Jerusalem where they used to do the sacrifice.
There are several temple festivals throughout the year, and so you would go to Jerusalem at that point in time, and it wasn't like people were scattered all over the world at that point. They were not too far.
Sure.
So these were pilgrimage festivals, and you'd go there and you'd bring an offering of grain of some sort or an animal you'd bring for sacrifice.
And then they will consume it afterward, or they will just...
Some of it was actually feeding the priests.
Okay,
but nobody's done this for over 2,000 years.
No. So, but even, I'm just for historical purpose, understanding whether they were using it or it was sacred that nobody can eat.
No, I think they were used.
Right.
Well, that wraps up our latest session of Oasis, and hope you all have enjoyed it. And as you can tell, we wander around all kinds of topics and issues. This is KHOI 89.1 FM, and we hope you've enjoyed the program tonight. Thank you for listening.
That's a wrap.
Today we have been listening to a conversation of Oasis, an interfaith group of local residents who gather to converse as neighbors. You are welcome to join the conversations. Persons of no faith are welcome as well. For information, contact us at khoiradio@gmail.com. That's khoiradio@gmail.com or at 515-292-2878. 515-292-2878. Or come and visit us at 410 Douglas Avenue in downtown Ames, in the old Ames Pantorium building. You can listen to this show online if you go to khoifm.org, go to the Shows tab on the homepage, and choose the drop-down box called Heart of Iowa. This program was engineered by Richard Morrison and edited by myself, Ursula Rudenberg. KHOI Community Radio is made possible by you as a participating listener, and we thank you for listening.